Hey, hello and welcome to the Unsightly American Soccer Podcast for that sort of netherworld period during the semifinals of this year's World Cup and just after them. We come to you in two parts today with several different guests. The first dedicated to a pair of mates of mine. First, Spencer Robinson, a soccer football commentator with ESPN Star Sports out of Hong Kong. And the second with old friend Esteban, Stephen Myers, who weighs in from San Francisco. In part two, and it will be in two parts, two separate podcasts to be accessed here at alphillips.net. We will revisit with Stephen and talk a little further after both semifinals had been finished. And similarly, we will talk to Dave Bautista about Sunday's final. A chance to catch up on everything that's happened in the last 4 or 5 days prior to Sunday's final. So we hope you enjoy. Let's get started.
So what time will the semi-final be on for you guys?
2:30 in the afternoon here.
Oh, well, that's much better. It's 2:30 in the morning here, so I think you've got it better than I have. I'm torn whether to get up. I'll definitely get up for the Spain-Germany one tomorrow.
Yes.
But I'm kind of torn for today's one.
What do you reckon today? The Netherlands should not have too much trouble with Uruguay, I imagine.
No, they shouldn't. But the sad thing from our point of view is that it should be Korea they're playing, not Uruguay. I mean, Korea should have beaten them. They deserve to beat them. And I'm sure they would have gone on. But no, you'd think at this stage that Holland should win. The other one, it's just too close to call, I think. It really could go either way.
Indeed. Hey, let's back up. Is that the view from Asia, that South Korea really got jobbed or missed an opportunity to beat Uruguay? Because it's not been the view that I've heard here and read from the European press.
Well, it's my view.
Well, all right then.
I'm very happy to cause a bit of controversy on that.
Well, they were a very capable side, as Japan showed itself to be, and a good showing for Asia getting two teams through to the final 16, but I guess maybe people are looking for a bit more.
No, you're right. Look, they would have settled for that at the start of the tournament, but having got there, certainly Korea should have gone on, and what, Japan lost in the penalty shootout, so that could have gone either way. I think the Koreans were a better team, but... No, look, I think they've shown that they're ready on the world stage now, wherever the tournament is.
They certainly have moved from the stage where we respect their skill and their speed, and they actually are physically big enough to mix it up, and do mix it up, and can play a team like Uruguay that's very physical and not seem overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on, and... Look, I think the confidence they got from obviously reaching the semis when they were at home. I think when you get a few of their guys now playing in Europe, so they're up against these top guys week in, week out. They know what it's about. So, no, absolutely. I think, you know, the race is on. Is it going to be an Asian team or an African team that's going to win it first? I'd certainly put money on them winning it before England win it next.
Yes.
But let's not go that route.
No. I will say that I think Uruguay is a much, much better team than anybody expected to see, and we always expect a very hard team, a well organized defensive team, maybe even a cynically organized defensive team. But the difference between this team and other Uruguay teams is they've got three excellent strikers, and Forlan may be the man of the tournament so far for me.
Yeah, not far off. I have to say, I mean, Holland, I've been a bit disappointed with. It sounds bizarre because to me, in every game I've seen that they've played, they've done the bare minimum they've needed and done it very well to get through, but they haven't really set anything alike me. I mean, Robin obviously is the danger man. He looks great on the ball, but no, Schneider and Van Persie, I think they've been a bit below par, and maybe they've been saving it up for Uruguay in the final. We'll see.
Certainly Van Persie's been fairly invisible, but Schneider's, I mean, certainly on the ball a lot and scored twice. Well, they didn't give you credit for that goal against Brazil, did they, the first one?
I thought they were, that was going to, what do they call it, the dubious goals panel or whatever they call it. they're going to ask that Uruguayan linesman who missed Frank Lampard's over the line one, I think.
You're right. We make fun of England. They're such easy targets. But that game is so different. If it's 2-2 at halftime, they don't go forward the way they do in the second half and get caught out twice.
No, but you'd still have had to have favoured Germany. I mean, England were poor, and over the course of it, they didn't deserve it. And I think, again, what we saw with Germany, the way they dismantled Argentina, it was just some wonderful football. And, it's just been refreshing to see the way that they've played and attacked. Because, again, if you go back, a lot of the German teams that have been successful in the past have been accused of being quite dour and not so exciting. But some of the young kids they've got, Müller and Ozil, is it? I think they're going to be now sort of favourites for the next two or three World Cups, I think.
What a difference not having Balak really made in their favour. They put Schweinsteiger back at defensive midfielder, and he's done a creditable job, and it enables you to bring in, like you say, Ozil, who's really a revelation. What a player.
Absolutely. And it shows you the funny twists, I guess, with any sports tournament or football tournament. But you're right. I mean, I think Germany would have been a much less dynamic team if Balak was playing. And it's turned out to be a great blessing. You know, again, maybe the reverse you can say with England, that had Ferdinand particularly stayed fit, there wouldn't have been some of the defensive howlers that there have been. But having said that, if we are going to discuss this, Capello is going to get a lot of flack. I mean, he made some very poor decisions, no question. And the British media, which I follow very closely, I mean, some of them are astonished that they've kept him in the position, and it seems purely a financial decision now that the FA cannot afford to get rid of him. I think he's contracted for something like £12 million.
Well, the hypocrisy is what struck me. He made such a point of saying, look, I'm only going to bring people who are fit and in form, and he brought Ferdinand and King.
Well, then he compounds that first game, when he plays Milner, who had been ill for a week and didn't last 20 minutes or half an hour. He'd left Walcott back, which was astonishing when all the indications were that he was going to be the outlet on the right side. It was one very poor decision after another. And when that happens, you question the decision-making process. And when it's somebody who is being paid £6 million a year to do that job, it kind of rankles a bit with the fans of that country who have paid huge sums of money to travel to South Africa to support their country. And as I say, I think it's quite astonishing that he's remained in that position. But maybe he'll redeem himself in the Euros in 2 years and the next World Cup in Brazil. We'll see.
Where is the European Championship being held in 2 years? I don't even know.
I've forgotten.
I think so many of us assumed, and you know, we can they would do well enough that Capello would be allowed and may decide on his own, that you know, while the experience in England was highly remunerative, he would step away, and then someone like Redknapp or Roy Hodgson or someone would get to coach the Euros. It's a bit of a shock that he's staying on, isn't it?
Well, as I say, it seems to me, and from the people I've spoken to and the people I know, that it's purely down to the financial situation. It's raised the whole question, though, you know, about we had Svenjer and Eriksson, and, you know, he took them to the last, to the quarterfinals, and he got chastised and criticized for a lot of things. But actually, he probably did as well as this set of England players, the so-called golden era, deserved or were capable of doing. It begs the whole question, though, and this is the other debate, I think, going on in England at the moment, about you really have to have an English manager. And, you know, I think if you look at the major countries, Germany have a German manager. You know, the top teams, Spain have a Spanish, the Dutch have a Dutch manager. it just doesn't make sense where you have someone and, Capello speaks a smattering of English, but certainly not good enough to communicate properly with the team when it comes to tactics. And I think the feeling now is that when he goes, and that presumably will be if they don't qualify for the Euros or if they don't do very well there, that the next manager must be English, no question about it. And, I hear people say, oh, there are no candidates, but I don't agree. I mean, I think someone like Redknapp or Hodgson, as you've said, even some of the younger guys coming through, you look at what Klinsmann did before. There's a case for saying, okay, give it to Alan Shearer or someone like that who at least knows the players, who's going to G them up and who's going to have some passion about them. And that, as we saw, was sadly lacking, Hal, in the England setup anyway.
Yeah. Well, I guess, the Maradona example is too singular to use as an example, but you can get away coaching a World Cup tournament, any tournament, on emotion if your team essentially selects itself. You're not required to do a whole lot of tactical managing unless you go behind and you don't do anything like Maradona did, but it can be done.
Look, absolutely. What coaching do these players need? You're talking about the best players in the world anyway. They're super fit. Okay, some of them may be a bit tired after a long European season, but I won't be having that as an excuse. I think that's nonsense. They need to be put into a cohesive unit. But if the players are good enough, which, as I say, to get selected for the World Cup, you have to be, the coach doesn't, in my view, have to do a great deal more than keep the team spirit up. People know what their job is. So obviously, set pieces they work on at the training, both offensively and defensively. Those are the key issues. But, as I say, and it raises the whole question, why would anyone pay you £6 million to do that job? I'll put my hand up, Hal. I'll go for that if they're looking for someone.
So who do you like, Spain or Germany?
I mean, on the basis of what I've seen in this World Cup, Germany deserve to go on and win it. They've been the best team. They've been a breath of fresh air. There's been, particularly the early stages, were very bland, and I don't think there was a great deal to excite. But they've really lit up the tournament. They've had a tough passage. I mean, they've demolished England. They've demolished Argentina. I kind of fear if they peak too soon, I think they'll miss Müller against Spain. Mm-hmm. Spain, again, have this unbelievable David Villa. What a player he is. And I just fear he might nick one and the Spaniards could do it. Let's remember, they're the European champions. They beat Germany 2 years ago to win that. Torres hasn't really performed at his best yet. I gather Fabregas is going to play in the semi-final. He's got a huge point to prove. All this debate still about, is he going to go to Barcelona? Is he going to stay at Arsenal? There's all these factors. And I've just got this gut feeling, Hal, that Spain are going to do it. They're going to reach the final. Although, in many ways, I think it's the Germans who deserve to be there.
I think you're exactly right. I think the Germans have played their best football already, and the Spanish have yet to play it. And Torres is due to score at least one goal in this tournament, and although he's been very average.
We said about Messi and Rooney, and they left without scoring, so maybe not.
He's got a team around him, though, and the others didn't. I want to see a Spain and Dutch final, because then we'll have a first-time winner regardless.
Good point. Yeah, well, I think, look, it's such a great occasion anyway, and it will be wonderful. Again, just as a final point, it's strange how quickly it's turned around. When we got to the knockout stages, everyone saying it's South American tournament, Europe have failed, France are out, Italy are out, the two finalists from 4 years ago. And look at it now as we go into the semis, three European and one underdog South American. So maybe Uruguay can still throw a spanner in the works. We'll just have to see how that pans out tonight.
Very, very interesting. Well, thanks for your thoughts nonetheless.
Great stuff. Look forward to watching it.
Hey, just as a segue to some football talk, I got several comments after the last the last podcast because you call me Bluto and Senator. Maybe you want to let the people know why that is.
Well, to those in the AlPhillips.net listening audience, we were schoolmates in college, matriculating at Wesleyan University, and we were on the soccer team, and a couple of years above us, I was 1 year above me, was a great soccer player, captain of the team. In fact, he won All-American laurels. And at some point, I guess in Hal's freshman year, so before I got there, given Hal's body shape and big personality, occasionally bloviating because of the great smarts and the great voice, this guy, John Nathan, bestowed him with what stuck as a nickname, and said, "Don't be such a blue, or you're such a Bluto." Or he called him Bluto. This guy, John Nathan, called him Bluto. So when I arrived as a freshman at Wesleyan University and went out for the soccer team, didn't make the varsity team as a freshman. The next year was Hal's teammate. That was it. You know, Hal Phillips was Bluto to those of us who were soccer players at Wesleyan. And if you remember, as so many of us do, let's see, I was 13 when Animal House came out. At the very end, you know, when they're showing the freeze frame clips of all of the main characters and what became of them, we read as John Belushi is speeding away with one of the sorority girls, you know, that he's abducted, who's on his arm in a Cadillac, Senator and Mrs. John Blutarski. And so I'm the only one, I think, who's taken it a step further. But I do refer to Hal occasionally, well, in formal situations and greetings and salutations and written and emailed as Senator. So there you have it.
Excellent, Tracy. I like that. And can I mention, too, John Nathan? It's a nice reference there. John was an excellent player. He grew up in Westport, Connecticut, and I guess he did make All-American, didn't he? But he was a petulant captain. You know, he was not a leader of men. And, you know, he would sort of pick on people in a fun way. But here's my classic John Nathan story. I think my sophomore year, we were playing Babson at home. And there was a free kick somewhere within 20, 25 yards of the goal. And he wanted it, and I wanted it. And, you know, I was the striker. He was, you know, some kind of halfback. And somehow I prevailed upon him. At which point I skied it over the crossbar horribly. And, you know, you sort of skulk back after a moment like that. But John Nathan, leader of men, turns to me as we're running back on defense and says, "Hey, Bluto, too many bong hits?"
Yes, of course that would have explained the missed kick, which we're seeing all the time in this Mundial. All the time.
Well, last time we spoke, Stephen, Ghana had just defeated the United States in thrilling fashion. Their exit from the tournament might have been one of the most dramatic moments I've ever seen on a soccer field. It was incredible to see that final penalty kick on literally the last kick of overtime missed.
Yeah.
And then to see Guyon not just chosen to take a penalty in the final sort of elimination penalty kick round, but to take the first one was really extraordinary. And to make it, can you imagine?
Well, I thought it was coming, actually. I thought that he had to be in the group and that you had to put him there. That's what I was expecting. I don't want to crow. I don't want to sound like I'm crowing about this. So that didn't surprise me, but it was a great moment. But worse, much, much worse, because there was a fatalism that hung all over that PK shootout for his having missed that penalty and doing so badly, huh, Bluto? I mean, he leaned back. The keeper had already moved. If he had just reacted and just pushed the ball into the goal, he hit it too hard. We're seeing that again and again, the very poor discernment, the thought process of players all the time, blasting away. If you remember Andres Iniesta in the round of 16, when he scored the second goal for Spain, mm-hmm. after that remarkable 45-meter goal into the open net after the Chileno goalkeeper came out, made the big tackle, the ball kicked all the way over to the sideline to Villa, the goal scorer for Spain, and he did an excellent job with the long shot, directing it right into goal. Well, the second goal that Spain scored to give them some distance, even though they really had a nightmare of a time with that Chilean team, by Iniesta showed what players ought to be doing with this ball. Not overstriking it, not hitting it too hard. Again and again, we're seeing that the players simply can't control the damn thing. Iniesta just firmly connected with the ball, and you know, the speed comes because the damn thing flies so fast, it moves so fast, and it beat the keeper. The goal I'm speaking about, Hal?
It was the ball can be bent, and you know, Kaká actually bent the ball beautifully against the Dutch while they were still. Well, I think they had just gone up 1-0, and Stekelenburg made the save of the tournament. On that shot, it really turned the game in a lot of ways. But
That saved Holland.
Yeah, it can. There's no doubt about it. It can be bent, but like you said, he didn't try to bend it. You know, violently. It was an open footed caress, and that's all you need.
Yeah, Kaká could have been better on that moment because there was a meter and a half of goal further and to the right. Kaká was not good in this tournament. And you know, I'll just mention again how that last year in April I toured South Africa with the singing group Vukani Mawethu, the voice of the movement out here for 25 years in the Bay Area. And we were on a humanitarian and cultural tour of South Africa all over the country. And the sporting figure that dominated the commercial landscape was Kaká, you know, the white guy of Brazil. The other African team that made it far into the tournament. Very much a star player and, you know, the brain of AC Milan. But a guy who hasn't been playing as well in the last 3 years as he did when he exploded onto the world, you know, the top of the world about 4 seasons ago, I would say.
So how would you explain the lords of Nike would choose Kaká not for a worldwide campaign, but for a billboard campaign or whatever you're talking about, this representation in South Africa? Why would they choose Kaká in a place like South Africa?
And he's wearing his AC Milan shirt.
What?
In so many of the advertisements. It's just because he is a world figure and one of the biggest teams and a great player and iconic of the Brazilian team. So, you know, I'm not saying he's not a great player. Actually, you know, I'm rambling a bit here. But Kaká was borderline ubiquitous last April, so that's 15 months ago in South Africa. I was, you know, in the big cities and all over the country. He was the athletic figure who exceeded all others.
It reminds me. Did you read that profile of Jacob Zuma in the New Yorker this week?
I saw that it was there. I haven't read it. No.
It's not bad.
When we were in South Africa is when the elections happened. Actually, something very ironic. We were in Mozambique. We were in a neighboring country on the day that the elections happened. And it's an enormous thing, a day of national elections in South Africa, as you appreciate for sure. You know, it was a great irony that our group, this group that through art, and through the songs of Southern Africa and through protest, you know, was so devoted to precisely the democratic process coming to South Africa. You know, in the, you know, across the 70s and the 80s, well, all of the decades when the apartheid movement was in place, that we happened to be out of the country on our 2-day journey over to, from Joburg, over to Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, and back. We just happened to be out of the country when elections were happening, when everyone was going to the polls. It's a great thing. So Zuma was a very likely winner, and he did win. Very, very interesting figure. I'll look for that profile.
Yeah, it's a good I think a good catch up for a lot of Americans who probably have heard of him and maybe knew that he succeeded in Mbeki, but don't really know much about the guy. I can't say that I did. But let's get back to the football.
Yeah, let me swing it back to football here, but also combining the historical and the political, Hal. The Brazil-Holland match. And what a result that those of us, you know, with our ethnocentric perspectives, really don't have an understanding of just how significant the Brazilian national team is in that culture of a couple hundred million people, that enormous country. and, you know, what happens in the World Cup every 4 years, and just how this whole enormous, miscegenated, you know, remarkable society is transfixed and but also devoted to the fortune of this, the Selección.
Try this on for size, Stephen. I thought, you know, a lot was said about Dunga and the team he chose, it being, you know, 11 Dungas, a much more hardworking, defensive, rear guard, protecting team than is normally chosen by anyone
right.
who leads Brazil.
Right.
You couldn't argue with the results. I think over the last 4 years, they had been beaten only once or twice. And at times in this tournament and most tournaments, they look fabulous doing it. But I guess the thing that struck me about Brazil this time was an imperiousness, a disdain almost for teams that dared challenge them, that dared roll on the ground trying to elicit a yellow card when this is something that all Brazilians do, of course. They're no different than anyone else. And
yeah.
there was a bullying quality to their attitude in these games. And
well, those
were
the type of players that he fielded. You know,
yes.
they were
but
yeah,
as with
very
all bullies,
athletic, very powerful, and also rough and tumble footballers.
But with all bullies, you don't really you separate a bully from a true strongman when you smack him in the mouth.
You're right.
A bully like Mike Tyson against Buster Douglas folds up and is never the same. And when that team gave up that goal, and when they gave up the second goal to the Dutch, they rolled over. They didn't ever sort of countenance the idea that they could be beaten. And if you don't do that, and you fall behind, how do you react?
They looked dumbstruck.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't a great sort of intelligence to the team. And then the guy made the bonehead move. Here's where I wanted to go apart from the Brazilians. But back in South Africa, what happens? This is the traditionally strong European team, Holland, the Dutch. You know, they've got a great football history. But who are the Dutch? Well, the Dutch are the ancestors of the Afrikaners,
yep.
of the Boers. In South Africa, we've got three peoples. The enormous majority, black Africans of very many nations and tribes, the dominant people. The English white folks, the South Africans of English descent, and their sport is cricket, as you understand, Hal. Soccer is the sport of the black people. And the Afrikaners, the Boers, beneficiaries and the strong men, if you will, of the apartheid movement. And the Dutch, you know, they deserved their victory. They won the game. But this poet and this traveler and this man who loves justice is not at all happy, given the historical relationship between Holland and the Dutch and the same host nation, South Africa, where the Afrikaners.
Well, two things. The first, I'll ask quickly. Have you ever seen the movie Breaker Morant?
Breaker Morant.
I've seen it a number of times. I know it very well.
It's one of my favorite films ever.
Yeah. Well, I love a movie about a poet, you know?
Exactly. And also a movie about so many timely, timeless factors like, you know, how you defeat an insurgency, even if you outgun it. It's still relevant today. But also just a beautiful film to look at. And,
yes. Beautiful.
Elegiac, really. But historically speaking, from a football perspective, the Dutch have played the Brazilians very, very well over the years and lost to them in penalty kicks in 1998 in a semifinal. They lost to them in the round of 16 or maybe a quarterfinal in 94, 3-2. I mean, this is a team that has played the Brazilians very well. There's only a handful of teams in the world who stand up and play the Brazilians toe-to-toe. The Dutch do it. The Argentinians do it. And we were hoping the Spanish would do it. Now we'll never know. The other thing that I can understand your historic perspective and say, well, it's ironic, maybe a sad irony that the Dutch have won this game on African soil. But, you know, the Dutch are the best team ever to win a World Cup. They played the best soccer for about a decade and lost in two World Cup finals to two host nations, Germany in 74,
yeah,
Argentina
yep.
in 78. So, in a way, historically, from a football perspective, football-only perspective, I thought justice was done.
Well, I'm glad that you offer those leavening ideas. You're right. And, you know, I know the history, too, and I agree with you in that, and that was well put, Senator. Changing back to that same idea of, I think, the coach the coach's choices, having bitten himself, team, and country in the ass, was Argentina, who were outplayed and outclassed. But didn't we all recognize that Maradona, and so many in the world recognize, Maradona did not bring the best team to South Africa, notably absent the captain of Europe's club champion, Zanetti, the Argentinian, who is just an unsurpassable wing defensive player for Inter Milan, was not chosen by the egomaniacal and also just, you know, three screws loose coach. And also, the defensive midfielder for the same team, Inter Milan, champion of Europe, the player I thought was the most important player on the pitch in their two games against Football Club Barcelona in the semifinals, Cambiasso.
Yeah.
So that these two players were notably missing against Germany, who exposed Argentina as unfit to go further. He fucked up his team. Because
yes, he did. But wasn't it interesting that by the time they kicked off against Germany in the quarterfinal, he had started to create believers, even amongst cultured and experienced soccer observers. They were beginning
wonder. His team had gotten the results.
Exactly. Yep. But look at the teams they played. You know, they played nobody in their group. South Korea was the best team they played. And they took a game from Mexico where
they were a good team.
Really,
I liked the way they played.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's right. That's right, Hal.
And
they were a big fish, swimming with smaller ones, and it was easy for Maradona to have his moments.
Exactly.
And to jump around, and you know.
There is a lot to be said. I think too much is put down to tactics in a tournament like this, where you're playing and fielding, you know, such a talented side as Argentina can field, even though people took issue with the team that Maradona did bring. That still had an embarrassment of riches there, but you know, again, you don't know what a team can do until it's gone behind, and you know, here's a team that had not been behind in the entire tournament, just like Brazil.
Yep.
Had not been behind the entire tournament, and how do they respond? They wilted. I mean, and look at the teams that were resilient from South America. Uruguay showed incredible resilience, coming back to tie that game against Ghana and ultimately win by the skin of their teeth, but I was very impressed with Paraguay. They did not play as negative a game as I anticipated they would. They scared the life out of Spain. They could have won that game. Straight up.
Yes, they could have.
That's the surprise and the irony of the tournament, is that there was so much praise lavished on the Titans from South America. And at one point, you know, we did have four teams out of eight from South America in the tournament. But the two teams that actually, I thought, acquitted themselves better in that crucible were the smaller countries. Who showed a resilience that neither Argentina nor Brazil came close to showing. And in fact, I mean, it was really a disappointment. I mean, Argentina, 4-0? I mean, come on. That closes part one of the Unsightly American Soccer Podcast World Cup Final Preview. Please click on or download part two for continuing conversation of World Cup buildup. Everything you need to know prior to Sunday. Thanks.